Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for grabbing the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, we're going to hop on the crazy train and get off in Arizona, where they have such threats of terrorism that Arizona has its own anti-terrorism laws. Investigative reporter Bo Hodai digs into this and finds some alarming cases of people prosecuted under the looser standards of Arizona law. This podcast is made possible by people who subscribe, like Jeffrey Lipinski, Don Cisney, Julie Dupree, Casey Condon. I really appreciate your support, and I'd like to see others join in. I'm talking about you. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. And I've got some new bonus books that aren't on the bonus book page yet. I've got copies of Thomas Frank's Listen Liberal for new annual subscribers who give me a mailing address in the continental U.S. Investigative journalist Bo Hodai has been on the Peter B. Collins Show before, helping expose the role of the Homeland Security Department and related entities in the roll-up of Occupy Phoenix. And Bo Hodai is a homesteader out in the wilds of southern Arizona, where he joins us again today as we warm up a little bit of Mark Lindsay, a 1970 hit about Arizona. Doesn't anybody know how to pray? Arizona, take off your rainbow shades. Arizona, have another look at the world by mine. All right, Bo, take off those rainbow shades, will you please, and join us here on the podcast. Welcome back.
Hey, how are you doing, Peter?
Always good to talk to you. And as you know, I've got a high regard for your journalism and the work that you've done. You work primarily from public records, and I find that you have a very high standard of the work that you do. And I'm impressed by the piece published this week at The Progressive. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast. And the headline reads, Arizona's Manufactured Terrorism Threat. And I mentioned to you, Bo, before we started recording that you're part of a two-piece package here. Yesterday, I interviewed Trevor Aronson, who published a powerful four-part series at The Intercept recently about the FBI, the investigations into suspects of so-called domestic terrorism. And Trevor Aronson said, when I asked him, how many of the almost 800 prosecutions since 9/11 were for serious violent threats? And he said, oh, you could count them on two hands. And so you're helping expose, I think, an interesting element of this, where the state of Arizona has passed one law that's in effect and a new one that just got signed by the governor that allows prosecution for so-called terrorism offenses. But the standards of those laws are even lower than the ones used by the FBI and the Federal Justice Department to sting and often frame suspects of, like I say, so-called domestic terrorism.
Right. That's definitely the important thing. And I want to say also, I think Aronson does some really solid work, and I'm honored to be in his company on your show, as in your company also. Thanks for all the praise. The thing about this trend is that it's a trend, a new trend underway where the FBI, rather than using the standards that are not very high at the federal level in order to prosecute terrorism cases, where you could, you know, look at the facts and argue there really is not a threat. The FBI instead has apparently found a willing partner in the Arizona Attorney General who is willing to take advantage of Arizona's lax terrorism law in order to prosecute cases that are even flimsier than the standard fare.
And we're going to describe one case that really intrigues and outrages me, where the FBI followed this kid from the age of 14 to 18, and shortly after his 18th birthday, they bust him. And then they decide, you know, this is a pretty weak case, and we're not going to prosecute. The Justice Department, the feds, decided not to. And so the state stepped in and said, well, we can go lower than that. It's like a limbo law practice. How low can you go?
Yeah. And, you know, the prize at the end of the contest is, you know, I can't say with absolute certainty that this is what's on people's mind, but it certainly is useful, you know, useful headlines for electioneering. You know, it serves these people to have an electorate in a state of fear, and they can say that, look at how good of a job I've done of protecting you from all these threats. So, and the Arizona Attorney General is an elected official, by the way.
Mm-hmm. And so let's open up here with the case of Mahin Khan, a young man from Tucson. And this is what I just referred to. They started monitoring him at the age of 14. And, I mean, that's almost a violation of the juvenile laws, isn't it? Can you really sic an informant on a 14-year-old? Does American law and Arizona law permit that?
You know, I don't know. I don't know what sort of protections there are in law for a minor from the law.
Yeah.
That's a question. I've never seen any such law in my life, but it is a good question. You would think that people could benefit from such a law, but I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, we have a whole separate system for juveniles. It varies a little bit state by state, but for the most part, the media won't name a juvenile suspect, even of really serious crimes, until a prosecutor says, oh, we're going to try him as an adult. In many cases, you know, the juvenile system has diversions. They have programs to try to rehabilitate people without imprisoning them. And there is generally a separate juvenile prison system or jail system in most states. So to see that line crossed here is one of the things that jumped out at me first.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, in Arizona, under the administration of Governor Jan Brewer, the previous administration, the juvenile justice system was actually almost entirely, if not entirely, defunded. And I remember reading at that time that they were dumping kids into county jails with adults. So I don't know what's happened with it since, but the state of Arizona doesn't seem to have a very high level of concern for juveniles in the criminal justice system. But, you know, that's maybe a separate issue because, after all, we are talking about the FBI, which are federal actors.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't know. The FBI certainly didn't seem to have any compunction about targeting a child. And, you know, the way they did it is interesting. And actually, you know, I when I had my conversation with Mahin Khan's mother, she was telling me these things. And I said, at one point in time, I said, wow, that's really interesting. And she corrected me. She said, no, that's not interesting. That's horrible.
Yeah.
And it is. It's not. It's it may be interesting from those, you know, for those of us standing afar, but it's not an intellectual exercise. It is people's lives. It is a child who has basically been shipped from high school to a state prison for something pretty ridiculous.
Well, and as you point out in the story, Mahin Khan didn't attend traditional schools because of his behavioral and mental impairments. He's described as having the mental capacity of a 6-year-old, and that, once again, is a red flag. You know, how can you prosecute, even under these lower standards of Arizona law, and end up, you know, serving up an 8-year prison sentence to a teenager with the 6-year-old capabilities? I mean, right. That just screams outrage.
Well, you know, it's actually, I think the reality is actually worse than that. From what I understand, Attorney General Brnovich, the office of the Attorney General, wanted a greater sentence for Khan. And that's actually what a large part of this new law, SB 1350, that was signed into law by Governor Ducey in late March, is about. It's about adding or tacking on tougher mandatory minimums now to Arizona state terrorism law. Because he got 8 years now with a lifetime of probation. That wasn't enough. Now, if you're convicted under the same statute, it's something like an absolute minimum of 10 years and a presumptive sentence of, I think, 14 or 15 years. So it's actually a lot tougher. And the Attorney General's office lobbied for and got new terrorism offenses as well, expanded the definition of terrorism under Arizona law so that they can bring more of these cases. And that's, you know, it's. I don't want to put thoughts or words in the Attorney General's mouth, but it is good for business. You know, these are good headlines for a man that's got to run again for office.
Yeah,
well, I think we'll see more of them.
I mean, I'm aware of Brnovich, and he is climbing the ladder there. I imagine he wants to be governor of Arizona, and you know, this is one path that people have used in the past to. Use crackdown on crime to, kind of buttress your credentials to be a governor. So,
yeah.
Talk a little bit about the origins of this case. When did this young man draw attention of the FBI and they started to monitor his behavior?
Well, let's see. That was 2013, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He was, or his family, I suppose, was approached by the FBI. They, as Shazia Khan, his mother, told me, Mahin Khan had written an email or possibly a number of emails to one of his online instructors expressing anger over U.S. drone strikes in the Middle East. And
gosh, I've sent quite a few emails like that, Bo.
Yeah, and apparently, you know, he had said things like, and this is what his mom told me, that he had said things like, the president should be killed for what he has done to these other people, for all the people he has killed. It was not a explicit threat. It was not, we should kill. It was, he should be killed for what he has done.
So it was a moral judgment. It was not some sort of a threat of violence.
Exactly. That's mm-hmm. that's what his mom told me.
All right.
In any event, his instructor sent these emails to the FBI.
I see.
And the FBI showed up at his house. And according to Shazia Khan, when they came, they said, you know, Mahin needs to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. And she said that the family consented, her and her husband, Atif, consented to have Mahin taken for the psychiatric evaluation. And they consented, they said, because they were afraid that if they didn't, he would be arrested and the FBI would take him away. So the FBI then took him to a private mental health facility in Tucson, where he was committed and kept for 45 days.
Hmm.
And during that time, he was subject to, apparently, from what I've been told, counseling and medication that, according to Shazia, basically turned him into a zombie. She said that he was stumbling around and drooling, and, you know, he wasn't really present. And and then eventually his father, who is a doctor, got the hospital to admit that he's not a threat and say, okay, well, you can release him, and they released him.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI, according to Shazia, would visit Mahin every month or two and have discussions with him, ask him questions, talk about things at the Khan family residence. And she was saying that prior to the FBI's involvement with her son, he did not know anything about ISIS or, you know, these terrorist groups. That all came about, his knowledge of these things all came about through his interaction with the FBI. And those monthly or bimonthly visits, according to Shazia, lasted up until he was arrested. So it was a good 3 years mm-hmm. of continual visitation from the FBI.
And you describe a couple of people who are likely paid FBI informants, one who used the name Nathan, who attended the mosque of the Khan family. And later we'll talk about another one of these, probable people who were on the case there. This is a very common practice that we've seen. There are 15,000 or more paid FBI informants on the streets of the United States. Most of them are focused on local mosques. And we've seen one sting operation, one frame-up after another, of particularly troubled and kind of disconnected young men who draw the attention of these paid informants.
Yeah, it was really interesting. You know, I read that one of the articles in Aronson's series where it was very interesting because of the similarities of young men with mental deficiencies. We're talking about homeless guys, you know, and it just seems that they're sort of putting a table full of wares out there, and whoever wanders along and engages them in a pitch is who they get, arrest. Mm-hmm. And they seem to net a lot of guys with stunted intellects or mental health issues.
Yeah. Well, one of the key issues is that his mom, Shazia, kind of recognized that weird things were going on. And yep. This guy, Nathan, offered to let this 14-year-old boy move in with him.
Yeah.
I mean, this is mind-boggling.
Yeah, so it is really strange. This is the situation. There were, according to court documents, there were two known FBI employees in Mahin's orbit during this period of time. Those are confirmed. The one individual, Nathan, is believed by Shazia to have been an FBI informant. I don't know whether or not he's discussed in the court record, because obviously they're not attaching a name to, their discussion of these FBI personnel. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so what happened with Nathan was this guy apparently hung around their mosque presenting himself as an Afghan bodybuilding guy. And he was, according to Shazia, about 20 years old at this time, and this was not long after Mahin got out of the mental health facility, so he would still be, 14, maybe 15 years old at this time. And the situation in the Khan household was that the Khan family had taken away Mahin's cell phone because they didn't want him getting in trouble. The boy, had a stunted intellect. They knew that he had already gotten in trouble for opening his mouth, and, strange things were starting to happen. So they took away his cell phone. They didn't want their son getting into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So Nathan and subsequently other people would call him to talk to him on the Khan's family phone in the house, the landline. Yeah. And when this would happen, Shazia would pick up the phone and listen in. And she was telling me she heard Nathan talking to her son, who was, she said, 14 at the time, and she believed Nathan to be 20, saying, "Look, why don't you come live with me? I have all these people around me, and they'll protect you from the FBI." Because Mahin had hard feelings towards the FBI. He, according to Shazia, had a good deal of resentment against them for them having taken him and committed him into the mental health facility where he was doped up mm-hmm. on drugs that made him into a zombie who was drooling on himself.
Well, that's an understandable reaction, even if you're not somebody with a 6-year-old intellect.
Yeah, any 14, 15-year-old kid with an outstanding intellect would have that problem. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody likes being committed into mental health facilities and doped up.
Mm-hmm.
So
how did the other probable FBI undercover informant, Omar, surface in the Khan universe?
Omar came about following what was apparently a falling out. What happened with Nathan was that Shazia began making inquiries, and this speaks to what you're talking about with the paid informants at mosques. She said she began making inquiries about this older guy who is, surrounding her son within the local Tucson Muslim community, and was told in short order that people believed him to be an FBI informant. And she said it to me in such a matter-of-fact way. I asked her, I said, is this a common thing? And, she was saying this as if it was an everyday occurrence. And, I think in a lot of communities it would be a big deal if you found out there was an FBI informant in your midst. And they didn't seem fazed by it. And indeed, she told me it's a common occurrence within the Muslim community.
And you quote her in her own broken English, if you will. We tell everything about Nathan to the FBI also. We give his photograph. We give everything. But because that's their informer, that's why they don't do anything. You can't believe how they play this game.
Right. Yeah, she actually reported Nathan to the FBI trying to protect her son. And, she went on in that conversation to say she was, she felt that they had used her as well because she was keeping such a short leash on her son. It seemed that she felt that short leash had possibly caused resentment between her and her son, driving him further away and subsequently into their hands, into this group of people who had surrounded her kid. And she had another quote that didn't make it into the article that I thought was very compelling, where she said, the parents are sleeping inside and they're outside making plans. Because the FBI had actually given testimony in Mahin Khan's case, as I understand it, stating that for about 2 months prior to his arrest, he was under 24-hour surveillance, and they were literally sitting outside of his window watching him at night while he slept. So that when she said that, she wasn't talking figuratively. She was speaking figuratively. While the parents were inside sleeping, they were outside making plans.
Wow. This is just amazing. So follow the narrative here, and where does Omar come from, and what does he try to do?
Right. So Mahin had a falling out, it would seem, with Nathan. Somebody told him that Nathan was an FBI informer, and Mahin actually put out a tweet saying, I'm going to kill this guy. Nathan went by a different name within the community. He went by Nathan in another name, and he said, fucking FBI dogs.
Hmm.
And I said, what about this? And Shazia said, he hates the FBI for what they've done to him. It's not the prettiest language, but that's, he hated the FBI at that point.
Yeah.
And so he broke off communication with Nathan, apparently. And shortly after that, I believe that was May of 2015. I think it was in October of 2015. He had somehow come into communication with this other guy who was discussed in the court record, who Shazia identifies as a man she knew by the name of Omar.
Mm-hmm.
And Omar apparently presented himself as being some kind of ISIS operative. And there was another FBI employee in addition to Omar around Mahin at that time, who apparently was working with Omar, whose name I don't know. And in the court record, Shazia's attempts to protect her son and restrict his communications, keep him safe, keep him out of trouble. She was listening in to conversations that Omar would have with her son, because he would have to call the house phone, the landline, because they had taken away his cell phone. Mm-hmm. And so she would listen in, and she at one point said, you know, interrupted this conversation and said on the phone to Omar, "Why are you calling? Why are you bothering my son? You leave him alone, or I'm going to report you to the FBI." Again, I don't know whether she did report Omar to the FBI, but here she is threatening to report this guy to the FBI. And she goes on to say, you know, "I'm so stupid because I don't know. I'm threatening to report this guy to the FBI, who is an FBI employee."
Well, I mean, you can imagine Omar got a bonus when this report was made.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also perverse.
Yeah, it is. And what's even more perverse is, so, you know, obviously this is a problem for the FBI, who can't have this protective mother, you know, stepping in. So they actually made plans to get Mahin, her son, a cell phone so that they could have constant, unfettered access to the boy. And they did this. It took them about a month and a half, I believe, between early April of 2016 and I think late May of 2016, two undercover FBI agents, Omar and this other guy, to get smuggle Mahin a cell phone so they could have constant uninterrupted access to him. And that's how protective Shazia was. It took them a month and a half to smuggle the boy a phone. And what finally happened was Shazia went to visit family in Minnesota, and I believe Mahin was staying with other family in Tucson who were as vigilant as she was, and that's when these undercover agents smuggled the boy the phone.
And I'll just underscore that this occurred before his 18th birthday. So they were intervening with a minor over the approval. I mean, we can't say that the FBI knew that Shazia objected to her son having a cell phone, but you have to imagine that they
did. They did. It's reflected in the court record. There's a part of the court record that talks about how the family had at one point in time taken away his phone, and then at one point in time given him a phone because he was working on, I think it was a school project.
They
were very, very well aware of whether or not he had a phone. Mm-hmm. And there is a part of the court record that talks about the family's preference for him. I forget the wording exactly, but it's linked in the article, the actual document, where it's very telling. They certainly did know what the parents' intention was.
Okay. So what is your sense from the court records of what the monitoring of Mahin's cell phone produced in terms of evidence that was used at the Arizona state trial?
Right. So here's the thing about Arizona state law that I think, probably the most newsworthy aspect of this article. It is the commencement of a trend where the FBI is seeking out lower standards of prosecution for their already very low threshold of investigation and entrapment. And Arizona happens to be a good environment for that because of the way Arizona law is written. And Arizona terrorism law states that it's actually two parts. You have conspiracy law, and you have the offense of terrorism and offenses under terrorism. Terrorism is classed as a violent felony upon the person. And conspiracy law in Arizona states that you must have overt acts demonstrating furtherance of a conspiracy unless you're talking about a conspiracy to commit a violent felony or a felony upon the person, which terrorism is. In which case, you only need to have a demonstrable agreement. So, to simplify it, all they need to have to say that you are engaged in a terrorism conspiracy is an agreement. And that's where the phone came into play, because they could, what seems to have happened is they would call Mahin, get this boy in conversation, and all they would need to say is, do you agree that this should be attacked?
Mm-hmm.
And if he said yes, then bam, they can prosecute him under terrorism conspiracy law in Arizona. Under federal law, you actually need to have overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, like somebody giving somebody money to procure a weapon,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
So this just becomes more and more outrageous, Bo, as we learn more about the details of this case. And one of the critical points that you note in the article is that, and I'm inferring here, so correct me if I infer incorrectly, but that in one of these conversations, they got him to say, oh, let's attack the Air Force Recruitment Center in Tucson. Now, that's federal property, and under the FBI investigation, had the Justice Department decided to prosecute, that might have been an actionable issue. But under Arizona law, you point out, attacking a federal property is not covered. And so
right.
What you describe is that, according to court documents, Khan agreed with a co-conspirator to an attack on a state motor vehicle building. And you say this communication most likely took place through the cell phone provided by the FBI. Now, again, given the 6-year-old mental level of this guy who is just about to turn 18 at this stage, it's pretty easy to imagine how you could get him to say things. You can just lead him right into it.
Yeah, and speaking to that, this is something that absolutely needs to be said in reference to this. There is a high level of secrecy around this case. What the FBI did, and this didn't make it into the article, though I wish it had, what the FBI did was when they brought this case to the Arizona Attorney General's office and the Arizona Attorney General decided that they were going to take the case, and this happened in the other terrorism prosecution as well, or one of the others, the I think it was the Thompson case, the FBI had the Arizona Attorney General's office sign basically a non-disclosure agreement stating that they would not release any of the case file under Arizona public records law, and that rather all records fell under federal FOIA law, Freedom of Information Act, which is a lot more restrictive than Arizona public records law. And to anybody who's ever FOIA'd the FBI, as anybody who's ever done that knows, you have to wait. It is going to be a minimum of 2 years at least before you get a response from the FBI if you submit a FOIA. And it's going to be 6 years before you get – actually, well, maybe not 6 years. Maybe I'm being harsh. 4 years before you actually get a partial release to your FOIA request.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there are just so many troubling aspects to this case. And, this is the only report that I've seen on it, Bo. And again, I compliment you for digging into it and finding the court records to support the reporting that you have provided. But this is deeply outrageous, and yet I'm not hearing any outrage except from you and me.
Yeah, it's really very bad, you know. I'm sorry, I wanted to address something that you brought up. I got off on a bit of a tangent about the secrecy, but yes,
yeah, go ahead.
When you're talking about the statute, you're absolutely right. So Arizona, even though the threshold for prosecution under Arizona law was desirous to the FBI, there was a complication in the Arizona law as it pertained to terrorism at that time only applied to targets that were state buildings. So when you said we're going to attack or agreed that somebody should attack the Air Force Recruitment Center, they couldn't prosecute that because that was a federal target. And this was actually disclosed to me by Mia Garcia, the public information officer at the Attorney General's office. Her exact words were, we hit a loophole when trying to prosecute this case. So even though the probable cause statement at the time of Mahin Khan's arrest stated an entirely different alleged terrorism conspiracy, which was allegedly against his Air Force Recruitment Center, the actual indictment that was handed down 5 days following the arrest by the Arizona Attorney General's office changed the facts of the case completely, stating that he had agreed that somebody should attack a motor vehicle office in Mesa, which is a suburb of Phoenix, which is also strange because, you know, as Shazia told me, he doesn't know anything about Phoenix, and he has, in fact, lived in Tucson his entire life, which is, you know, over 100 miles from Mesa. And the court record also does disclose that that agreement was made over, one document says texts and one says emails, but either way, it appears very likely that it took place, was facilitated through the cell phone that the FBI gave him, and that it likely took place with Omar. Actually, it was Omar. It was the man that Shazia knew as Omar. That much is absolutely known.
And Bo, describe the, was this a jury trial, and how much did the jury deliberate over the Mahin Khan case?
No, it wasn't a jury trial, and this speaks to what the last question you had asked on outrage. The local Arizona press, as a matter of fact, the national press picked up on this story, and I guess it was sort of sensational because here we have this teenager who had, you know, fortuitously for the prosecution, just turned 18, but still a teenager, who is a you know, a terrible jihadist. Everybody, all media outlets, with the exception of a few articles, were very dutiful stenographers for the Attorney General and the FBI, and basically, you know, laid out this, you know, very scary story that they wanted out there. The Khan family did get a little bit of assistance from local media when they put out a statement explaining that, you know, Mahin has these cognitive problems, and that they had actually cooperated in every respect for the FBI or with the FBI and had been doing so for several years. Other than that, though, nobody would help them. There was nobody in their corner.
Did they waive the right to a jury?
Yes. And Mahin Khan was arrested on July 1st, and by, I think it was the end of the first week in October, he had accepted a plea agreement. And so he had waived his right to trial by jury. And as it was told to me by Shazia, you know, the boy is now an adult, so he's going to make the call. And he made the call. He said, I can't do it. They're saying that if I don't take this, they're going to give me 25 years. If I do take this, they're going to give me 8. So he opted to take the plea agreement.
And this is another factor that I discussed with Trevor Aronson, that in a large number of these cases, I think, let me just, I'm going to look it up here. I've got it on my computer screen. The number of people who took a plea bargain, so that we have, you know, no real information on the trial. So the total is 796 terrorism prosecutions since 9/11, and 523 of those have been plea deals. And so those are cases like the underwear bomber who flew into Detroit. We don't have any independent information about his case. We only have selective leaks from well-placed FBI sources who, by the way, will never be sanctioned for leaking. And so this is a feature, if you will, of the pattern of these FBI domestic terrorism cases, where they overcharge the individuals, they scare the shit out of them with, you know, the prospect of life in prison or something close to it, and then they just dispense with the case, you know, with, in this instance, an 8-year sentence. And of course, this limits discovery. It limits any cross-examination of witnesses, exposure of the underhanded tactics of the FBI, the payments to the informants, the extent to which informants are, you know, singing so that they can avoid prosecution of liabilities of their own. I mean, this is just such a sordid cycle that is populated by a lot of dirty people, including some who work for the U.S. government.
Yeah. No, it's very true. I think that the culture of plea agreements in these cases, as well as in other cases, you know, I spent about a year and a half suing the city of Tucson over their over records relating to their use of Stingray cellular surveillance. And what I learned there is, you know, the FBI is very dedicated to keeping certain things out of the courtroom. you know, and in the case of Stingray, they've actually instructed prosecutors to dump cases if it looks like there might be any disclosure of tradecraft. And I believe that it's probably very much the same with these terrorism cases. You know, they don't want them. I'm fairly confident we can say they don't want them to actually go before a jury, because they would have to disclose things like these dirty tricks, smuggling a child, a cell phone, mm-hmm. and, you know, things like this. Another part of it is, again, you know, the sort of prejudicial nature of the stenographer media. The defense, Mahin Khan, actually, his attorney was a public defender. His family had to go with a public defender, which is, I mean, the man seems to have done a good job for a public defender, but we all know that public defenders have very large caseloads and are very underfunded. And he actually argued in the case to keep the press out of the courtroom at a certain phase, because the press, he felt and argued, was being so prejudicial that it would be impossible for them to find a non-prejudiced jury in the area if the case did go to trial.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bo, you've done a great job exposing this, and I want to mention as we wrap up here that there are three other individuals, two different cases that you explore in this article. And in one of them, you cover the critical issue of, you know, what is a criminal expression of support for example, the Islamic State. And that's something I also discussed with Trevor Aronson in my conversation. And I think this is an important issue because it's really a very fuzzy standard. You know, at what point does, you know, if you object to American drone strikes and if you object to American soldiers on Muslim soil and you feel that, you know, you have a righteous right to have an alliance mentally, okay? I can support mentally and rhetorically, the actions of individuals that I don't support financially or militarily or, you know, by showing up to fight. And, you know, Americans don't have a clear idea of which foreign fighting groups you can join without being punished and which ones you can. And, for example, you know, there are over a dozen different militia groups fighting in Syria right now. Not all of them are on the American terrorism list. And so if I went and joined one of those, for example, Saudi-funded proxy groups that nominally is aligned with the United States in fighting the Islamic State and the Assad government, am I committing a crime? I don't know.
Yeah, the Thompson case is interesting, Derek Raymond Thompson, because he didn't even get to that point. You know, it was strictly rhetorical. The entire thing is being prosecuted on the strength, if you can call it strength, of words. And you know, one important part of that discussion is the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project that does lay a line of delineation between allowed speech and criminal speech in terms of material support for a terrorist organization. And I think a ruling that's been rightly criticized by a lot of free speech advocates because it does curtail freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. However, even in this case, it does not criminally curtail what Mr. Thompson has done or said. So in that ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that you're all right to express support for a group like ISIS, a foreign terrorist organization, so long as it's being done as independent speech and not under the direction of that organization, in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's still a pretty murky standard, and you can see how it is manipulated in these cases, and the, you know, the weakest legal frame for these investigations and prosecutions is conspiracy to commit material support. I mean, you know, that means you shared your thought with one other person. And therefore, that becomes a conspiracy, and you know, other laws kick in with significant penalties. It's just an amazing minefield.
Yeah, if you have just a minute, I want to say something about that in reference to the Thompson's case. So, yeah, what they did was they said, okay, we've got these social media statements and Google searches, none of which were either an explicit or I would say even an implicit threat. It's just a guy committing Google searches or stating things that could be interpreted as supportive of ISIS in YouTube video comments. No threats. And, of course, threats largely are not protected speech, but there were no threats. So we've got that. The FBI has that. They say, well, we've got all these comments this guy made and all these Google searches that we think indicate that he's thinking about doing something. And then they coupled that with an email that this man allegedly wrote to a gun seller or a guy selling a handgun through Backpage.com, in which he wrote the guy and said, do you still have the nine millimeter handgun? If not, you know, I might be interested in buying something else when I get back to town. The guy said, no, that's it, and the conversation ended. Mr. Thompson was a felon who has not had his rights restored at that time. Still, that was the extent of the attempt to acquire a handgun. That conversation allegedly took place on January 26th of 2015. Derek Thompson was arrested on, I think it was December 20th, of 2016. So it's almost 2 years between his arrest and that conversation, and mixed with a number of statements that the FBI says are supportive of ISIS over since 2014 is what they're saying, since July of 2014. All of that added together means that he was planning on committing a lone wolf attack in support of ISIS. And that's it's quite a stretch.
Yeah.
It's their calculus is, well, we have these statements that are seemingly supportive of ISIS, and we have this one email that we can frame as a attempted misconduct with a weapon, and that this is a prohibited possessor talking to somebody about acquiring a firearm. Mix them all together over a nearly three-year period and come up with a terrorism case.
It's amazing. Bo, I want to thank you for the excellent work you're doing. We'll continue to follow it. And as I mentioned, I will link to your article at The Progressive in the show file for today's podcast. Bo Hodai, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with journalist Bo Hodai. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.